Good afternoon, and welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Most of you know I'm David Berto. I'm the director of our Defense Industrial Initiatives Group here at CSIS. With me is Guy Benari, who is my deputy and the deputy director for DIG. This is the fifth year in one way or other that we have had an event like this where we've talked about European defense trends and what's going on in Europe and both what it means from a demand side and a supply side and what we should be thinking about it. It's unique today, though, because we are juxtaposed here in the basement of CSIS with another event. There's an event that is explaining the importance of and national security implications of the election in Japan. That event will be going on behind the wall there. It hasn't started yet, which is why we actually have the quiet that we have in this room right now. We're in the middle of a pivot to Asia. That's what the strategic guidance says from last January 5th, issued by the Defense Department. And I think it's representative of this kind of dynamic because there are actually four thrusts inside that strategic guidance. One is the strategic rebalancing to Asia, which has been the one that has gotten the most play in the media and on the Hill with the Congress. But there are three other thrusts, one of which is continued focus on the war on counterterrorism. The third is continued emphasis on the Middle East, both the peace process and security in the Middle East, which is obviously important not only for U.S. security, but global security and global trade. And the fourth is a rebalancing in Asia. But it is not a rebalancing in Europe, but it's not a rebalancing to Europe. It's in essence a rebalancing from Europe. And what we are going to look at today has to be seen in that broader context. Let me welcome also our viewers on the web, we're delighted that you can join us on a webcast here. I would ask you, those of you in the room, to silence your cell phones, we're in a space where we'll be happy to hear it, but not all that happy to hear it. So I'm going to leave mine on, because when we get to the question and answer period, we'll put up our email address, and we can get questions from the viewers on the web as well. For those of you on the web also, you should have been able to find and download the charts for today's briefing and follow along with us. We're also using what for us is a fairly new technology application for CSIS, which hopefully the viewers on the web will be able to see both the talking heads, such as Guy and myself, as well as the charts themselves. And we'll find out how that's going to work. We won't know. Actually, we're just going to be sitting here talking. But you will find out how that works pretty quickly as far as that goes. So it's a new, we're moving into the 21st century in our technology applications, and that will work out pretty well. As I said, this is actually the fourth time we've done this. It's our third major report on European defense trends. And we're very happy to be releasing this today and happy that you all were able to come along and go with us. When we first started it, Europe was in a slight decline in terms of defense spending. As we'll see today, that decline has been accelerating over the last few years. Obviously, the American relationship with our European allies is one of the oldest and strongest that we have. When it comes to building partnership capacity, which is a global objective of the Defense Department and of our national security establishment, it's also important to recognize that we need to preserve partnership capacity where we already have it. Nowhere do we have greater partnership capacity than with our collective alliance with NATO, and particularly the special relationships with the UK, with France, and with others. In addition, we've now been through a decade of war with our European allies, and particularly the NATO role in Afghanistan still has quite high prominence and high regard. We're, notwithstanding the popular view, which is we're already gone, we are not already gone from Afghanistan. Troops and units are continuing to rotate in. Missions are still being executed. There's a lot of effort still underway there. NATO's clearly playing a strong role there as well. And we have seen the influence of that kind of dynamic, the operations and the operational dynamic across Europe over the last decade as well. We'll cover some of that today. The chart says that Joachim Hofbauer is briefing us as well. He is unfortunately ill today. We wish him a speedy recovery. His absence will be noted more by Guy and myself up here because of what he won't be able to say. But we want to recognize the significant contribution that he made. He's really been the father of this report as we've driven it through. I would also like to acknowledge some of the others who contributed. Priscilla Herman and Sneha Raghavan are our other lead authors, and we thank them for a tremendous amount of work. Ryan Crotty, David Morrow, and Greg Sanders made enormous contributions to various sections of the report as well. And so this has really been a team effort as we put out today. Guy, do you want to add anything else in introduction before we go to the next chart?
No, let's go ahead and get started.
All right. We're going to go through the charts pretty quickly. We'll let you know where they are in the report. For those of you at home, we'll let you know what chart we're on. And then we'll get to the end. We'll open up the floor for questions and comments and reactions. So this is kind of what we're going to cover today. We'll talk a little bit about methodology. We look at both the demand side and the supply side. And so the demand side is basically what the budgets are, and we'll cover the European budgets. In Europe, there's also a couple of pretty substantial regulatory issues, primarily having to do with the EU new regulations on both procurement and on transfers. We've covered those in previous efforts. We'll update you both on the substance and the status of those today. We also look at the supply side, the European security and industrial base. And we've covered this in the past. We have some methodologies we use in that regard. We're updating the data on that as well. What's new in this report is a much more substantial look at the trend analysis, because we've got some pretty substantial data now over the last decade, and we can look at where it's going and what it likely means for European defense spending, some of the future spending trajectories that come from that. A couple of options that Europe has for perhaps changing that trajectory, those projections, if that's desired, and then some areas for further research. Let me say a little bit about the methodology, the next chart. We cover essentially all European defense spending. Our sources of data are multitudinous. We rely primarily first on NATO data, which is both somewhat standardized, although you got to work at it pretty hard to discover the standardization in some cases, and pretty consistent year over year. It's the thing it's least consistent on is when it's actually released, and so our analytical process often is held up because it could come out in February or it could come out in June. NATO has its own calendar, I suppose. But we also supplement that with enormous additional amounts of data sources. There's a whole section in the report on methodology, and it cites a lot of those. We then do a lot of analysis of the data ourselves, and particularly try to regularize and standardize data across from sources and over time. And in particular, what we try to do is reach some categories of defense spending that allows us to compare across countries and longitudinally over the evolution of time. And these are categories very familiar to the U.S. because they're the same categories we follow in our own defense budget. Essentially, military personnel, operation and maintenance spending, procurement spending, research and development spending or investment spending as well. And so if we look at those categories, we try to compare European spending and trends inside those categories with ours for the demand side. For the supply side, we tend to focus on, from the company point of view, publicly traded European companies. And that allows us to both have a pretty robust database across Europe, but it also allows us to sort of discount, if you will, for the vagaries that occur from government ownership, both in terms of revenue, profit, margins, and the kind of typical financial comparisons that we would use for companies. In order to do that, we created some time ago our own European Security Defense Index, and that is the basis of our section in the report that covers that. We'll go through those charts as well. Again, there's a couple pages on the details of the methodology in the back, and we'd be happy to answer any questions in that regard. So, let me go to the next chart. This is chart 4 if you're following along. This is has two data trends on it. One is the bright red line. The other is the dotted blue line. The dotted blue line is actually defense spending in constant euros from 2001 through 2011, which is the last year for which we have data. And you can see from the trend there that actually it's been a pretty steady downward trend. There was a little bump up in the middle of the aughts, 05, 06, 07. This is, again, in terms of constant euros. And while that's true for most of the members of NATO and the EU, a lot of other currencies are involved in there as well. The red line is spending per soldier. And one of the early discoveries we made when we started tackling this problem is that notwithstanding the decline in overall European defense spending, the spending per soldier was actually going up. Now, this is essentially an arithmetic calculation. We take total spending divided by the number of active duty military. right? But it serves as a pretty good surrogate for a couple of things. One is the level of investment in technology in the individual military or in the collective military. Because as we look across the world at nations, there's a high correlation between militaries that are technologically sophisticated and that use equipment both for communications and integration and for combat, and the spending per soldier dollars that calculate from the budget. That correlation is almost a 1.0 correlation. I don't think we've ever done a double regression analysis, but it's pretty obvious just from looking at the data. So it's a pretty good surrogate for the technology investment. Obviously, it doesn't bring training or readiness into account, but there's also a correlation between military that invest from a technology and equipment point of view in their active duty military and those that actually also spend the money to be trained and ready and deployable as well along those lines. So it's a pretty good surrogate in that regard. And a number of European countries are at the top of the list. U.S. is obviously number one worldwide. We should actually think about putting out a report on global spending per soldier, if you will. A number of European countries and Canada, Australia, not surprisingly, are not far behind. In Asia, as we found in our Asia study, really only Japan is at the same level as the U.S. There's another reason for that, though, in terms of the data and that trend, and that is that Europe, over the course of the first decade of the 21st century, a number of countries made dramatic reductions in their active duty personnel, either because they were reducing in general or because they were transitioning from a conscript-based army to a professional career volunteer army or military, if you will. And so that skews the numbers as well. So even as spending was going down, the spending per soldier goes up. From a company's point of view, particularly companies that are in the business of, in fact, providing the technology and the equipment, this has been a pretty good news story. Because it says the market actually is still there. The demand is still there. The opportunity to gain benefit from investment in technology is still there. What we've seen here in 2010 and 11 is essentially a continuing decline in overall expenditure rates, but a flattening of the spending per soldier. As when we talk to the trends, we'll talk about this a little bit further in terms of projections. We're not sure that that will continue. By and large, other than Turkey, most European countries with large numbers of military now have made that transition from a conscript-based military to a professional military, and so there's less opportunity, I think, going forward for the payoffs, if you will, in that regard. So with that, let me hand this over to Guy, and you'll go to the next one.
So now we'll talk a little bit about the categories that David mentioned earlier. These are the spending categories that the U.S. uses, NATO uses, and we've tried to standardize the spending in the non-NATO countries in Europe along similar categories where possible. In some cases, that was an easier task. In others, it was harder. But where possible, we try to break down all the budgets that we looked at for 37 countries, so not just the European Union members, not just the NATO members, but really all of Europe, and break those budgets down into these categories that you have before you. So let's take a quick look at the categories. I'll start from the top, actually, because there's an interesting story right there. That's the little dotted black section or striped black section at the top of each of the bars is research and development, defense research and development spending. And as you can see, that's been the category that's fallen the hardest in these last 10, 11 years. We don't have data for 2011. This is the only category where our data only go up to 2010. But in 2010, there was about half of what was spent in 2001, spent on defense research and development. So down from almost 13 billion in 2001 to just over 6 billion euros in 2010. And that's a drop of about 8-9% every year. And if that trend continues, we'll really start asking some hard questions, not just we, but everybody, I think, about investments in future capabilities. Obviously, research and development represents the investment that a country is making in its future technology and military capability. And this trend is quite worrisome for us.
Yeah, and let me add to that, Guy, that from an export point of view, and we'll see this when we get to the section on the supply side on the company's performance. They've increasingly come to rely on exports as a source of revenue. The extent to which there's a correlation between being competitive in the global export market and having invested in R&D at the front end is, we think, pretty high, and there's a very strong possibility that this reduction in investment in research from a European company's point of view could lead to a reduction in their competitiveness in a global export market over time as well.
Right.
That's one of the things that we'll be watching for going forward. Let me go to the next chart. This
Hold
is.
Hold on, sorry.
Oh,
I'm saying. There's more categories.
Oh, there are more categories. You're right. Some of us think R&D is in fact the only thing that matters, but it's not.
Very quickly on these others, though. The next one from the top, the slight green bar, is infrastructure. That's the category that's dropped the second fastest after R&D, at about 3.5% per year. And now accounts for about 3 to 2.5% of overall spending, largely as a result of reductions in force structure. The infrastructure that's needed to support that force structure goes down as well, and that's what we're seeing here. The sort of purple section there is O&M, operations and maintenance spending. And that category has actually been quite steady throughout the time period that we've looked at, largely explained and pretty obviously by operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and the participation of European allies in those. Personnel is the biggest section in each of these bars, obviously, about 55% in 2001, coming down, though, to about 52% of the share of the overall defense spending in Europe in 2011, but still a significant investment there, over 100 billion euros spent on personnel. And then, interestingly enough, the category other than O&M that's fallen at the lowest rate is the lower bar, or the lower section in each of the bars, the blue section. And that is equipment, and that for us is one of the probably few good news stories here for Europe, in that they have managed to largely protect their equipment accounts from the drops in the budgets that they've all been experiencing. Interestingly enough, I think in the U.S., the historic trends have been that when we draw down our defense budgets, one of the first accounts that we hit for savings is the investment account, so R&D and equipment. In Europe's case, that's not been true. And in fact, about 20% of the annual defense spending has been dedicated year on year to equipment, and we've not seen a big change in that.
And that is a big difference in the U.S. We've looked at the last two major drawdowns in the United States, the post-Vietnam drawdown in the 1970s, the post-Cold War drawdown in the 1990s.
Right.
In each of those drawdowns, the percentage decline in procurement and investment accounts in the U.S. defense budget had been dramatically greater than the overall percentage in reduction. For Europe over the last decade, it's been dramatically less. There's some question as to whether they can be maintained over time,
right,
as well, particularly without the R&D investment. Now let me go more officially to chart six. This is really a section of the report that covers spending on collaborative efforts, if you will. There's been a tendency in Europe over time for defense dollars to be spent inside the country of origin. And there's some pretty strong tendencies for security of supply reasons, that's the nice phrase to use, to spend your dollars on defense on a host nation, on your own companies and your own equipment, if you will. And this, the data here on chart six sort of validates and verifies that, if you will. The large blue section, which is tends to range in the 80 to 75% range, is money that's spent internally within the country. The red part is from other European collaborative, and then the very top is from collaborative efforts as well. So within EDA member states, the vast majority of the expenditures are domestically oriented. Now, this does not, we can't discount or take out of here, for instance, a European subsidiary of a U.S. company. right? So we're looking at the actual location of the work as opposed to the ownership structure of the company when we look at these data. But it basically shows that most of the money being spent is still being spent internally. Similarly, for research and technology, which is a subset of R&D for EDA member states, this is even stronger the case. The R&D money is being spent internally. So these are reflected more completely in the report, if you will. Let me move on now to chart 8. This is figure 14 and page 28 in your book. So I've kind of skipped ahead a little bit in the report, if you will, and talk somewhat section on the regulatory reform efforts. We've been tracking for some time the EU Defense Procurement Directive, which was enacted back in 2009, and the intra-EU Transfer Directive enacted in 2009 as well, both of which sort of succeeded the Article 296 rules about using exceptions to, essentially non-competitive exceptions to award work, defense work to countries, companies within the country. The idea behind both of these 2009 directives, first was to open the European markets more broadly for total European competition, if you will, and secondly, to remove some of the barriers for transfer of, and particularly licenses and technology transfer within that intra-European market, if you will. We've been wrestling with this and tracking it since 2009 for two reasons. One is, if in fact it's successfully implemented, it offers the opportunity for a better European market, better investment in technology, more competitive European defense industry, and quite frankly could support the basic idea behind NATO and EU defense of let's rationalize as we're reducing, let's not all get rid of the same thing, let's maintain coherent capabilities across Europe that gives greater capability in the aggregate than any individual country brings to the table. These regulations would support, if properly implemented, that kind of an outcome, if you will. We also have been tracking it because there's a little bit of concern that if they were implemented in such a way that they'd be a competitive disadvantage for U.S. companies who were trying to compete in the European market. So we've been tracking it from both of those perspectives, both as a possible enhancement of overall European defense capability and as a possible barrier to competitiveness of U.S. companies in the market. So the basic idea contained in the circle at the bottom is to open the market for defense and security-related procurement. Well, so the challenges. The market is very fragmented. Export regulations and offsets kind of make that market more difficult to operate in. And there is a fair amount of visible public interference, government interference, in the state of the defense industry by channeling work to a particular country. All right. So what's happened since 2009? Initially, the target completion date for implementation was August of 2011, and for the transfer in June of 2011. The initial reflection by most of the member countries tended to ignore those dates. Gradually, the EU started actually implementing procedures to call into question member states' failure to comply. That tends to spur compliance and move forward. A large number of the states have indicated that they have complied by determining that their existing regulations are consistent with these directives, subject to national interpretation, of course. And in some cases, there actually have been new language put into place. The implementation is still not complete. I think it's fair to say that from our perspective, the results of the implementation so far have largely been inconsequential. And I refer you back to the charts that show that most of the money is still spent on internal domestic companies. And so we're really not seeing the full and final result. However, it could be that the combination of these directives and the global pressures for competition in global markets could lead to some changes in internal behavior as well as time goes by. Guy?
Thanks. Let's now take a quick look at the supply side. We've looked at the demand side, the regulatory framework at the European level. We'll now look, the next three charts are on what we would define as sort of the financial health of the industrial base. We use technically quite a few financial metrics used by Wall Street analysts and equity researchers to study companies. We don't study individual companies, but as David explained earlier, we aggregate about 22 publicly traded European defense and security companies. It's very hard in some cases to distinguish between those two categories, defense and security, and so rather than either reduce the size of our index or have to do a bit of legwork to quite a bit of legwork to distinguish within each company what goes to defense and what goes to security, our index covers both defense and security companies. As I said, about 22 of those from all over Europe, obviously because we're only looking at publicly traded companies, there's quite a few notable defense companies that are privately held and therefore not in this index, but we think it's still overall for trend analysis that gives you a pretty good picture of what the supply side is doing. So this first chart, actually the only line here that looks at the supply side is the red line at the bottom, which is the total revenue for the 22 companies in our index. The blue line is defense spending in Europe, and the green line at the bottom is spending in Europe on equipment. And so, as we've discussed earlier, the trends for total defense spending have been has been a downward one. The trend for equipment has been pretty much steady throughout the years. Interestingly, throughout this time, the companies' revenues have been going up. So how is this possible? Well, this tries to explain that. What you see here is for 3 years, 2003, 2008, and 2011, the breakdown of sources, geographical sources of revenue for the companies in our European index. The red part at the bottom is all the revenue that comes from Europe. The blue section in the middle of each bar is the revenue that comes from North America. Obviously, primarily the U.S., Canada not that big a defense spender. And the green at the top is sort of rest of the world. And so what we see is that while the share of the revenue that comes from Europe has held pretty steadily between 2008 and 2011, and as has the share that's been coming from sales. The biggest growing market for European companies is the rest of the world. So that's Asia, the Middle East, Latin America. That's how these companies have been able to, in the last few years, sustain their growth. Obviously, in the years before that, 2003 to 2008, the major source of revenue or growth in revenue was the North American market, primarily driven by, again, operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. But increasingly, as this chart will show, the European defense companies are not relying on Europe as the market, the growth market for their revenue. It's not even going to be the U.S. going forward. We believe it'll be those rest of the world countries, that green section at the top of each bar that's going to go up, while the European and probably also the U.S. sections will diminish. Anything to add here, David?
I'll come back to that chart.
Okay. And now, just for a quick overview of sort of the as we said, the health of the industrial base, looking at three metrics in particular. The first one, operating profit. We, again, use, well, actually here it's the blue line that represents the European index, and the red line is sort of the industry peers as represented by the MSCI index, but just for the industrial sub-index. So we're trying to, as much as possible, compare apples to apples here. It's not a one-to-one comparison. Obviously, the MSCI Industrials Index, we've removed the defense companies from that index. They're only represented in the CSIS index. And what's interesting is that these two lines track quite evenly. I mean, overall, there's not a huge difference in operating profits between the defense companies and the commercial industrial peers. Where that's beginning to change is the last year or two, and that'll be an interesting trend to follow. Again, sort of the European defense companies in blue and their industry peers in red. And so in terms of at least profitability by this metric, the defense companies are starting to see a bit of a decrease. I should add just a quick methodological note. As you've seen in the titles for each of these charts, we've weighted the index by revenue here so that there's an equal sort of effect by each of the companies as opposed to the index being skewed by the few very large companies in the index. So we're now looking at return on investment capital, essentially how well a company uses its money to generate profit or generate returns. Here, the picture is a little different from the profit picture, where we see that for the majority of the time period that we've analyzed, the defense companies actually have a higher return on invested capital than their industry peers in the commercial world. And it's actually been going up significantly in the last few years for the defense companies, as it has for the commercial companies, but a good news story here overall. Sorry. And then the last metric that we'll use for this presentation, at least, is CapEx, capital expenditure. This is a metric that looks more in the sort of medium to longer term, how companies are investing their money in fixed assets and other revenue-generating assets a little further on into the future. And here again, for the most part, here the picture is a little different. Where the industry peers, so the commercial companies, are doing a little better than the defense companies, with defense actually stagnating a little bit over the last few years, possibly indicating, again, it's you have to be careful with these metrics, but possibly indicating that the European defense companies are being a little more cautious in terms of sort of medium to longer term investments. They're sitting on quite a bit of cash as a result of a pretty good decade that's behind them. We think that the sense is that there's not much of a clear demand signal coming in the last few years from the European governments, from the European customers. And so, therefore, the companies are being a little more careful in their investments in the medium and longer term, and that's reflected here. And it's even more reflected in the next chart that David will talk about.
So, as we mentioned, from an R&D investment perspective, here the companies are really dramatically different than their domestic peers, if you will. I've got myself out of my chart line here. I was on chart. Yeah. Totally. We're on chart 14. I was lost, and so it's possible that some of our viewers on the web were lost as well. From a revenue-weighted R&D investment, though, European defense companies are far out-investing their commercial counterparts. This is not surprising, and they actually have the revenue to be able to do this as a result of lower capital expenditures that you saw on the previous chart. As we've seen, though, as a percentage of overall spending back at the beginning of this, that's declined considerably. So this is from a revenue-weighted perspective, and obviously as revenue goes down, R&D can go down, and it still looks pretty flat on this chart, if you will. Go to the next one. Looking at kind of the key trends overall, I mentioned already, and this is chart 15, if you're following along through the charts. This is not in your book, this list here. It's in your book as several pages of text. Force structure reductions are no longer expected to offset budget declines. And so what you've seen in Europe over the last decade is the reduction in strength has allowed a focus of the remaining dollars to still be spent on investments in such a way that it protects procurement and research and development. We do not see that trend continuing into the next decade. We optimistically say that the regulatory environment will lead the drive for market defragmentation. But quite frankly, this car is still in first gear, right? And it's heading in the right direction, but we have not yet seen the results of a more competitive intra-European market evolving from the procurement and transfer directives that we had expected to see. And as we saw from the chart 10, where we looked at the revenue sources for European companies, the growth has been in non-European, non-North American sales. And that's where these companies have been increasing their revenue over the last 3 or 4 years. Future European defense industrial capability, then, will depend increasingly on their competitiveness in that global defense market. And if you look at right now, they're competitive within Europe. One of the things that's happened in the defense industry, both with respect to the U.S. and with respect to Europe, and to some extent globally, but less so, is increasingly defense companies are part of the global financial market. You know, the way the defense industry evolved in America, and to a greater extent even the way it evolved in Europe, they were really independent of the global financial markets. Companies got their revenue from the government. They made their investments based on the government. They weren't all that worried about earnings per share or quarterly stock price changes or whether, in fact, the contract was awarded on the last day of one quarter or the first day of the next quarter. Increasingly, though, companies, both U.S. companies and European companies, are dependent on the global financial markets. They have to be competitive with their non-defense peers from a financial point of view. And we saw that, by and large, in Europe, they have been competitive right. in most of those categories. By the way, the same is true for the U.S. But they also have to be competitive in the global defense market with people who are not competing for the same access to European capital that they are. And they cannot, in our view, remain globally competitive if they continue to be protected by domestic preference for defense sales. This is where the progress in the regulatory environment is actually not only useful from a getting more bang for your buck from a European dollar point of view or euro point of view, but in fact allowing European companies to maintain a posture of more global competitiveness right. in the global defense market. And the U.S. has a policy stake here. You know, it's not in U.S. interest for Europe to decline. We can't floor up the numbers. You know, our U.S. own defense budget is going down and is likely to continue going down, even in the event of, you know, some deal that comes forward. I don't think anybody sees the defense budget in the U.S. going up anytime soon. I doubt that it will decline at the same rate as European does, and we'll see that when we land here. But it's certain that the U.S. has an interest in fact, maintaining that capacity and capability. Now we'll look at some of the trajectories.
So, yes, now let's take a bit of a look into the future. And we do that using this framework. So we've developed several spending scenarios. All of them are in the report. We'll look at some of them here that are based on two possibilities. One, and that's sort of the on your left-hand side, the first box from the top, is that Europe in terms of defense spending, declines at the rate that it's been declining for the last decade, basically. So about 1.8% compound annual growth rate, CAGR, so about 1.8% per year over a decade, the past decade. Let's assume that that trend continues in the coming years. And then the other two assumptions we make on top of that is about troop levels, whether they go up. I don't think anybody's anticipating that. Whether they remain relatively steady or they go down. And then the lower section in sort of dark gray is predictions based on the compound annual growth rates for defense spending in the last 3 years as opposed to the last decade, which have been significantly faster than those of the last 10 years overall. That's at about 3.2% per year. So assuming that level of decline in spending, let's see what happens if, again, troop levels are either maintained at the levels that they're currently at or they come down a little bit. So this is the projection for total defense spending. The red section at the bottom is the projection based on the decline at the three-year CAGR of 3.2%. The sort of upper section in dark blue is the decline based on the decade or 11-year CAGR of 1.8%. And so really the best case scenario, if the decline in the next few years occurs at the rate at which it's occurred in the last decade, we're still going to end up with total European defense spending levels of about $220-225 billion per year. That's compared to 275 billion euros in 2001. However, if the decline occurs or continues at the rate that it's been going for the last 3 years, we're going to end up at around 150 billion euros. That's sort of the worst case scenario in this trajectory or in this projection, 150 billion euros in 2020. Of course, the real worst case scenario is that the decline is at a faster rate than it's been in the last 3 years, but we didn't even want to look at that. Then we mentioned earlier this metric of per soldier defense spending, and this is looking at that metric again ahead into 2020 based on the two possible scenarios. The upper section starting in 2012 through 2020 looks at sort of the slow decline. What happens if Europe decline at 1.8% defense spending per year and actually continue to reduce troop levels? So that's a best case scenario or one of the better case scenarios. So slow decline in defense spending coupled with continued reductions in troop levels. And that'll get us up, obviously, in terms of the defense spending per soldier, up into the range of sort of 125,000 euros per soldier. The alternative scenario is that reductions in spending occur at the faster rate that they have come down in the last 3 years, but troop reductions continue, and you still get a bit of an increase in per-soldier spending. However, if the troop levels are held constant, and that, I think, is sort of our more likely scenario, there's no reductions in troop levels. This is the scenarios or the trajectories in per-soldier spending looking forward to 2020. So even under the best-case scenario here, which is sort of the dark blue section again on the top, there's still a continued decline in per-soldier spending. That decline becomes even more significant if the 3.2% reductions from the last 3 years continue into the future. And again, troop levels are held constant. The spending per soldier goes down significantly. Again, not an unlikely scenario and not a very pleasant one either.
So given that, what do we face? I think we conclude it is unlikely that we will avoid within Europe a decline in the available dollars. We think it's pretty inevitable that that budget decline that you've seen over the last few years. Frankly, I think both Guy and I would believe that the 3+% decline that you've seen over the last 5 years is more likely to be the trend that we're going to see going into the future. And even in terms of troop numbers, I mean, the UK has already announced a 20% reduction in its army, and I think we'll continue to see those kinds of changes as well. In particular, from the company's point of view, the inefficient resource utilization barriers, the tendency for domestic preference, which we call here market barriers across country borders. You saw back on chart 6 the fairly small percentage of euros that are spent in collaborative markets and the high percentage that's spent on domestic markets. It's difficult when you sit in the United States to blame anybody about an inefficient allocation process. But nonetheless, you would have a hard time saying that Europe's is efficient, even compared to the U.S. And by public sector over-involvement, what we really mean is there's still a tendency to look upon defense expenditures as a jobs program. Now, that's not unique to Europe. That's true across the world, and the U.S. has a tendency to do this as well. But it is a remarkably inefficient mechanism for investing in jobs. And you can never justify defense expenditures solely on the basis of preserving jobs. There's got to be a national security advantage that comes out of it, or you can't really justify the expenditures. It's a really inefficient mechanism. Again, it's a little difficult from the U.S. to accuse anyone of having a lack of strategic direction, although certainly the strategic guidance that the U.S. Promulgated back last January, is a very positive step in a direction and actually has contained within it what I would consider to be some pretty clear demand signals that would allow U.S. companies to tell where they ought to be investing. It is very difficult to get a similar strategic direction from NATO or the EU that would allow companies to say, okay, I know what my long-term demand trends are going to be here in terms of where to invest in that regard. So that's kind of a negative view. Where's the positive that you can take from that in terms of where we might go? If there are further troop reductions, that does affect the demand side. As we postulated in our view of per-soldier spending, up to a point, further troop reductions can actually concentrate spending on higher technology and higher investment equipment, which also adds to the benefits to the global alliance because you've got a greater potential for interoperability, for the ability to have federated capability where there's common equipment and common platforms, common data, common ISR, et cetera. More coordinated capability trade-off decisions. This is the basis for smart defense, right? But we've seen this story before in Europe and NATO of we're going to rationalize, we're going to determine how to measure the capability across Europe so that not everybody is coming down equally in places where they should, in fact, sustain themselves. This is the counterpart to a domestic-only focus, not only from the supply side but from the demand side as well. More effective and systematic forms of collaboration and cooperation. It's optimistic to think that these are evolving, but certainly the need is pretty clearly there. And we'll hopefully be able to emphasize that for more innovative business models. This, in fact, the directives will allow you to do this. Companies, if they're going to be competitive on a global defense market, are going to have to do this as well.
Sorry, just a quick note on that. Another thing that we mean here, and we're starting to see in Europe, and that's actually something to watch in the coming years as well, is delivering capabilities not by making and buying them. Which has sort of always been, both in the U.S. and in Europe, the traditional way of delivering capabilities, right? We need close air support, so we'll build some airplanes. We need, mine clearing, we'll build the ships. Increasingly, you're seeing different strategies and different... That's part of what we mean by the innovation here, is you're seeing things like the Salus Agreement to deliver airlift by leasing aircraft as opposed to buying them. You're seeing other interesting ways of sort of what is now called smart defense, again, not from a traditional make and buy model, but in other ways, leasing and et cetera.
And when it comes to collaboration, taking interoperability to a higher level, for instance, you saw in NATO operations involving Libya, British air crews flying U.S. aircraft, and because they had in fact trained together and owned and operated similar equipment. These are harbingers of some great potential future for getting more defense for less money, if you will. And the final part in terms of competition, there's ample evidence that you'll get more for your money if you have a strong competitive environment. And this requires, obviously, three things. One is a better definition of requirements and an ability to stick with that definition going forward. The second is a regulatory environment in which, in fact, competition is rewarded and decisions can be made. And the problem with competition is you actually have to let the losers lose as well as let the winners win. And this is a hard thing for governments to do sometimes, right? And then the final part is you have to have companies that are capable of competing and bringing both the technology and the performance ability to bear in that competitive environment so that when the winners win, there's actually some benefit from it. This is about as rosy a picture as we can paint going forward. What we certainly want to recommend from the regulatory environment is finalize the implementation of the reforms and then monitor and enforce their application. The test cases here will be critical. If a company or a country is actually brought inside the European Union system to essentially a court case, that's got to be very carefully selected so that it stands up and actually the benefits outweigh the political dimensions and cost. And with any luck, it'll be selected in such a way that it never actually comes to fruition, but we begin to see a little bit of the diminishing of the barriers to intra-European competition. And again, this is probably very strongly in the U.S. interest. On the supply side, Two strong recommendations. One is increasingly limit the public sector involvement on the supply side so the companies themselves can both become more of a private sector company and more competitive in the global market, and then to support exports more systematically and create more efficient and predictable frameworks. We see this within the U.S. as well. One of the biggest problems is requirements, particularly for foreign military sales and direct sales. There's a tendency of sort of everyone for themselves and whoever can sell first and get in there. Within Europe, we've had a long, strong tradition of how to allocate and prioritize. When you get out into the rest of the world, we saw this very strongly in the report we did last summer on Pacific Force posture. There's a much less of a tendency to be able to say, you know what, if I only have so much money, this is what's important for the alliance for you to spend it on. That's a much harder thing for us to answer around the world. It's important for both Europe and the U.S. going forward.
And then just sort of as a closing note, here's what we'll be looking at in the coming years, coming year. We want to look at import and export patterns, primarily at the transatlantic level, but also, again, as part of the tracking of how well the directives on intra-European defense trade are being implemented. We'll look at sort of internal and transatlantic export and import patterns. We want to expand our European Defense and Security Index beyond just those 22 publicly traded companies. Like I mentioned before, there's quite a few significant European companies that are either privately owned or government owned or a mix of both. We'll make an effort to get the financial data that is required for the analysis for those companies as well and thereby get a more accurate read on the health of the industrial base. And lastly, we'll take a look at developing some metrics that can help us gauge how effectively and how efficiently defense euros are being spent in Europe. And so it's not just a question of how much is being spent, but how well it's being spent. And we haven't quite gotten the how well section of it yet. Hopefully we will in the next year or so.
I would note we have a little trouble answering that question for the U.S. as well. What did we get for our money? So this is a kind of an endless task. I should also point out that the methodology and the approach that Guy and his team developed for European defense spending, we've also begun to apply this past year for the first time to Asian defense spending, where both the data are a lot less robust and available. There is no NATO to gather everything together. But the need for a better understanding and better analysis is clearly great as well. I'm going to put the last chart up. This is chart 25. This is the chart that has my email address. We've reached the conclusion, I think, of our presentation here today. We'd like to throw the floor open for questions. So the way we do this, even though it's kind of a small room, we want the viewers on the web to be able to follow this along as well. Raise your hand. We'll recognize you. We'll bring you a microphone. Wait until you get the mic. State your name and your affiliation, and then ask your question, and we'll have at it. So let's go with the first one up here, Jesse. And for those of you on the web, you can send your questions in to dberto@csis.org. All right. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Marisa Lino with Northrop Grumman. In looking at the last decade of European defense spending, your figures include the NATO operations in the Balkans, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan. With
as well as Libya.
And Libya, of course. I'm assuming, looking at this, at your conclusions, that the trends are very negative in terms of what Secretary General of NATO calls smart defense, because spending, there will be a reluctance to involve the NATO in further out of NATO operations because there is less money to go around, and there is the inherent reluctance to go beyond borders in terms of spending. I mean, we've seen how long it's taken to accomplish certain collaborative projects, years. So I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thanks. I have a couple comments. You may want to add a couple as well. It's probably true that it is certainly true that from the data point of view, The operation funding has been the most stable in terms of not being cut over the last decade. And this is in part driven by the fact that it's pretty hard to cut operation support while you actually have troops out in the field, right? And so that's going to be it. So the expectation would be that the reductions in operation would probably move up to the same as the reduction level that we've seen in the other overall accounts. We have no basis. We can't break out the numbers, so we don't actually know from the data how much was spent on Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, et cetera. On the other hand, of course, there's very much the possibility that some other operation will still emerge. Now, there's no other Libya out there, but there are other things going on that Europe could, in fact, or NATO could be involved in, like Syria, for example, right? And so, you know, the dynamics of what's going on in the world will have as much to say about that as well. But I think you raise, Marissa, a slightly larger question as well, which is, you know, what's the rationale and the argument for why you have national security spending and defense spending in European countries? And there's a grave concern that absent the appearance of an immediate or an existential threat, which obviously we had for many years with the Cold War, that the tendency is you don't have to spend any money at all, right? For some time, I think we recognize that there's really a pretty powerful dynamic at work here that if we're not careful, we'll try to replace something with nothing. And the extent to which we decry the tendency to spend defense dollars on internal companies does have one small advantage, which is it makes sure you keep spending money on defense, however inefficiently or ineffective it might be. Once you lose that, you've got to have something better to replace it. And I think a global view and a collaborative environment in which specialization can actually occur, it's very conceivable, and you could build a pretty good argument, that for less money you could have equal capability that you have out of Europe today, collectively. But to do so haphazardly is impossible. It's got to be done more rationally. To argue that, in fact, smart defense is going to provide that rational structure, the evidence isn't there right now. The theory sounds good, but the evidence is just not yet available. And so it's really something of, I think, pretty serious concern and something we need to watch. One of the things that we've stated before when we've had these reports is that we think the U.S. has a responsibility to actually play a bigger leadership role with regard to both stating that and fostering the behavior that leads to that kind of outcome. I think that need is still very much there.
And just a quick follow-up apropos smart defense, or you know, pooling and sharing, as the EU likes to call it. I think, to David's point, you can do more with less, especially in Europe, especially with all the overlap on both the demand and the supply side. So there's multiple programs that deliver similar capabilities across multiple countries, and if you did the right sort of level of coordination and synchronization, you could get more bang for your euro. I think maybe a way to incentivize that, and we've seen that across some of our projects, where once you get data on something, as bad as the data is, that's an incentive to improve it, and not just improve the data, but improve the what the data actually tells us or what the data is showing us. And so maybe getting at that issue by pulling out the numbers on smart defense on you know, if you, I'm trying to think how you might do that, but saying, okay, here's the capabilities represented by, or here's how smart defense is represented by certain capabilities, and let's track investment in those capabilities. I'm sure that, A, that will improve the data available. There's no smart defense breakdown of the NATO budgets right now, but I don't know, maybe there will be one going forward, or maybe we can push for one. But once the data is there, the data are there, I should say, I know you are mindful of that, but once the data are there, maybe that'll incentivize countries to actually put the money in as well.
There's probably one final point, and then we'll go to another question. The companies themselves recognize that they have to maintain a global competitive posture here. And the necessity for companies to be competitive in the global defense market does require different changes in behavior, and I think can help offset some of that tendency of, we're at peace, we don't need to spend this money, And if we're going to spend it, we don't actually need to get anything for it. So there's some optimism. European defense industry is a large enough enterprise, both collectively and some of the companies individually, that they actually have a say in that, both by their own decisions for their own investments, and they know they need to be competitive, and by their ability to help bring that up. This is a little bit out of character for European companies. They don't do what we would call lobbying, right? But there may be an evolving need for them to at least validate their own interests in survival and competitiveness,
right,
and invest and behave in such a way that is consistent with that. This is a big leap for European companies, but it's not outside the realm of the possible. We have other questions here.
I'm Harlan Ullman. Thanks for all the effort you put into this. My question is tinged with a lot more cynicism, because I think you're wildly optimistic about what's happening in Europe, David, and you know that. For better or worse, I've been sitting on the SACEUR advisory board for almost 10 years. I've been working with a number of major MODs, heads of defense staff, like. There's nobody in charge. You talk about NATO and smart defense. There is no smart defense. If you take a look at what Allied Command Transformation put out in terms of its 53 initiatives, it's going to achieve nothing. The EU isn't really providing a lot of leadership. The United States, in my judgment, has turned its back in Europe. We have had absolutely zero leadership there in terms of trying to use things more productively. So I think your analysis is terrific, and I think it's enormously useful. But my larger political question is, as Henry Kissinger famously said, who do I call when I try to get hold of Europe? How do we turn this around and bring some degree of rationality? If you've visited the NATO staff recently, as I'm sure you have, I would say it's far more centrifugal than it has been in a long time. So who is going to be the organizing factors here in terms of rationalizing, in terms of doing the really smart things that need to be done, when it looks like NATO is really concerning itself more introspectively with nation building at home? The EU remains obviously at loggerheads with NATO, and the United States does not appear to be taking a lead. Could it be through some of these regional arrangements? You've got the UK-French agreement, you've got the Nordic agreement, you've got the Romanians, for example, and the Poles doing collective R&D, things like that. Give us some hope.
I appreciate that question, Harlan. We are, I suppose, both by profession and by temperament optimists, or we wouldn't be in this business for very long. But I also think that it's easy to remain optimistic about European defense when you compare it to the rest of Europe on the overall European economy. I think there are three dynamics, though, that come to play here. One is that Europe's own awareness of its situation has been masked by both the level of conflict and the operations involved in supporting that conflict, by the reduction in troop numbers that has allowed you to feel like we're still doing a pretty good job of sustaining and maintaining the capability that we have going forward, and by essentially the rest of the world is paying attention to other parts of the world. At least the first two of those will cease to exist, and so there'll be greater clarity in terms of seeing what the actual consequences are. In addition, the focus on domestic preference for expenditures has not yet seen the kind of job losses and the kind of reductions in capability that I think will come forward. It may be that, in fact, it has to get a good bit worse before there's any motivation for it to get better. The final point is that typically the world provides us with opportunities to realize the trouble we're in before we hit rock bottom. Whether Syria would be that or whether something else will be that problem, we can't really tell. I think the point you made, though, about the opportunities for sort of maybe not Europe-wide capabilities, if you will. I mean, clearly the U.S.-UK relationship remains the special relationship, and I think it's important for the U.S. to continue to get that right. It's a difficult situation for Britain because they actually have to sort of figure out how to both remain engaged with the U.S. and engage more with Europe. This is a difficult challenge for the Brits. We've had a number of conversations with them here. We'll have that opportunity again in January. We'll have General Sir Peter Wall over talking about what the implications of reductions in British Army are going to mean. The UK-French alliance, of course, this is, what, our third try in the last 20 years at that, but this one looks like it may actually have a little bit of sort of subliminal staying power and produce something useful. you know, the possibility of Britain leaving the EU or changing its relationship with the EU, I think, has enormous security implications and is dwarfed by the broader economic considerations, but certainly needs to come into play. And frankly, I think the most important thing, and you're right, on this point we should probably be more vocal. The U.S. needs to play a more vital role, if not necessarily from a broader public point of view, at least from a foreign policy and a national security point of view in terms of being the voice there. That depends on SACEUR in many ways carrying that and the U.S. Representative to NATO, and there's a strong opportunity there. They might need more ammunition, and I think part of the role we play is, in fact, to provide some of that ammunition. So maybe what we do is we're going to actually take a third scenario, one in which, in fact, the acceleration in decline that we've seen over the last 4 years continues to increase and show what the net effect of that would be, because ultimately, unless you see the end of the road and say, I don't want to be there, you're not going to end up changing your path on the way. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, just a quick point. I think you're onto something with the regional sort of partnerships, and I think a combination of something like smart defense or pooling and sharing from the EU side and those regional initiatives is the way forward. Because I agree with David, you're not going to get smart defense at the collective 28 NATO members level right off the bat. It'll have to start small. It'll have to start with capabilities that where there's a history, either operational or on the R&D side of countries collaborating. So either they've built something together or they've been out in the field with it together. Or there's something else at play. There's similar cultures. That's why I think the Nordic and the Baltic regional initiatives are successful, because there's similar cultures, similar backgrounds, and a history of working together on other non-defense issues, maybe. And so I think this combination of smart defense or collaboration in defense at the sort of European level, in theory, provides the framework and provides a list of sort of certain capabilities, for example, that you want to maintain or improve in. But then the implementation happens at the regional level, at least initially, to sort of build the first cadre of success stories or good practices that others can learn from.
Hang on, let's get the mic back. We're always in favor of taking advantage of intellectual capacity elsewhere.
You remember many years ago, Bob Comer, bless his soul, became the special advisor to Harold Brown for NATO. We need the equivalent of a Bob Comer today, maybe working out of the White House. I think it's the only way you're going to be able to energize. SACEUR, quite frankly, does not have the clout. He doesn't get the support. The mill reps and the perm reps to NATO do not get the support. You need somebody who's going to be working possibly out of the White House, certainly for SecDef.
That's a recommendation worth thinking about. Thanks, Harlan. Let's go over here for the question, then I have one from the web.
Thank you. Scott Harris. For most of the last decade, I was with Lockheed Martin in Europe, learning about the inefficiencies of that marketplace. And a lot of what you say in the briefing today certainly rings true to me. My sense is that European industry is doing much worse than your data indicate. I think the economic crisis is really hurting them. I think the European data is, as you know, so hard to get, but if we really could look inside some of these companies, we'd find out that they're hollowing out. And there's going to be an implosion if things don't turn around. Given that, I think your recommendation that somehow if the marketplace were more integrated or more efficient, that would help considerably, less nationalistic. I actually think it can't be done on a Europe basis. I think it has to be a transatlantic basis. I think the survival of the European industrial base depends on their access to this market. Given that, I have two questions for you. One is, have you uncovered any data that would support the contention that some make that at the sub-tier level there is more integration going on? In other words, suppliers, secondary level operators, you know, the famous iceberg chart out of Al's old office. Is that below the level of the primes, is there integration going on either in European basis or transatlantically? And my second question is, in looking at this and the notion that exports are important to the future of Europe, have you been able to factor in what a euro at $1.30 does to their competitiveness? I don't think they can compete in Asia at a euro at this level.
Thank you, Scott. Those are both very excellent questions. And with respect to the validity of the data and whether it's masking, internal hollowing out, that's a suspicion that may well be true. We'll obviously, we can't penetrate that to the same degree that you can when you're in the market. On the question of the supplier, we only have the snapshot in time of the icebergs report, and that's about 5-6-year-old data now in terms of that. What we've seen anecdotally is probably a continuing integration, if you will. Part of that is through mergers and acquisitions. Even though you maintain the specific national companies, there's a greater integration. We've certainly seen that in the U.S. as well, although we don't have good public data. Again, we're only beginning to get good public data in U.S. contracts at the subcontractor level, and it'll be several years before we've got a pretty robust data set and enough to have trends, if you will, in terms of lines. But all the anecdotal evidence says we're still migrating to, A greater percentage of the work is done by subcontractors as opposed to primes, and B, primes are, in fact, oftentimes the major subs to other primes. So it's both a redistribution of work at the contract level from prime to sub, and an integration of primes being sub, prime here being sub elsewhere, and we think that's probably, we don't have a good measure for that, though. It's a perception. That's probably a plus in the sense that we all sink or swim together, right? With respect to the second part of your question, actually, would you ask that again?
Exchange rates.
I think that's an incredible point, and I think it's going to drive eventually, as we've seen, for instance, with some European commercial companies, Airbus, for instance, a very strong need to have a global footprint, or else they can't maintain that that competitive posture, if you will. But it may be that that problem also takes care of itself pretty quickly, depending on whether Europe can rescue itself or not. So it may be that that's more of a notional problem or than a real analytical problem going forward. Let me raise a question, thanks to Cecil Black from Boeing, who's watching on the web and sends in a question. Seems counterintuitive that European defense spending could be declining while troops are deployed and so on elsewhere. Makes one wonder if perhaps the decline has been to some extent enabled because the U.S. has been paying all or a substantial part of some of the European costs for conducting contingency operations. And I think that's actually a very interesting question. We don't have good data. But it's pretty apparent, for instance, if you look at operations in Afghanistan going on today, the U.S. is absorbing a substantial amount of the lift costs associated with these, a substantial amount of logistics costs in country, a substantial amount of the information surveillance and reconnaissance and the communications costs, and some of the initial medical and evacuation costs for those who have the misfortune of being wounded in combat. So, again, we don't have good data for that because the U.S. doesn't track its own expenditures in a way that allows it to allocate it to, you know, ISAF is ISAF as far as they're concerned. It's all part of the NATO operations. But I think that there is probably a masking there. If I were to guess, it's a percentage that's probably in the across Europe in terms of the billions of euros spent on operation. It's probably in the single digits rather than the double digits in terms of overall operation. But within those operations, in terms of the overall O&M expenditure Europe-wide, within the operations themselves, though, it's probably a very substantial cost and really unknown and unallocable. Would that, and to the extent that that's true, then there's less of a peace dividend, if you will, from the ending of these operations, and the European budgets will see less of a decline automatically occurring from not sending troops on deployment than it would otherwise. I have not seen or heard much in the way of expectations within European budgets of a peace dividend of ending operations in Afghanistan. But I know from personal experience that the general public tends to expect that dividend to be much larger than it really is, and it would not surprise me if that same thing were to occur in Europe as well. So thank you for that question, Cecil. Any other questions or comments in the room? Yes, sir. Here comes the mic.
I'm Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics. There was a question you raised at the beginning, and maybe you've already addressed it, but it was about the U.S. Companies having potentially a competitive disadvantage if Europe did, in fact, integrate.
Fully implement
the directives, and I'm just wondering if you could address that.
Yeah, let me explain the thinking, if you will, behind the potential competitive advantage. And this is more the transfer directive than the procurement directive. The idea that you intra-Europe trade, defense trade, only needs a single license for third-party transfers within the European Union. If a U.S. company is not inside that circle and cannot take advantage of that same transfer authority, then a U.S. company would have to have multiple licenses across multiple customers with the attendant loss of time, responsiveness, and additional costs and overhead to be borne there, whereas an inside European company with a single transfer could, in fact, undertake multiple deliveries and multiple contracts inside the same framework. So it's basically an assumption that the transaction costs would be greater for U.S. companies. Now, you can offset that in a number of ways, but it you know, the extent to which, and we find this to be largely a big deal, you know, the overall regime of export controls that fits inside the defense market really does slow down the process and add cost across the board and makes both U.S. and European companies to some extent less competitive in a global market. Now, at the high end of technology, that's still only the U.S. and European companies can do it, so it still remains there. So that's where the competitive disadvantage would come from. Now, one of the unanswered questions is, would a European subsidiary of a U.S. company be treated for purposes of the transfer authority as a European company? Our reading of it is it depends, right? And so we're going to have to wait until it's fully implemented and see what it looks like to be able to answer that question. Steve, and then Graham.
Hi.
Name?
I'm sorry, Steve Grundman from the Atlantic Council.
Thank you. I thought maybe you were looking at your notes to see.
No, I'm trying to think how to. Well, I guess now that Harlan's gone, I feel less reluctant to make this
He's
point.
He's still watching on the web.
You know, thank you for the data. The data are very, very interesting, and I dare say I think they outright contradict many of the conventional wisdoms we have about what's going on in European defense spending. Now, beneath the level of the top-level data, there are some interesting questions of the sort that Scott raised. But the data themselves are pretty interesting. You know, if you ask people, I think, imbued with the conventional wisdom, and I'll admit that even me, you know, I've largely been imbued with the conventional wisdom, how much has the European countries reduced defense spending over the last decade? Would I have said 15%? I'm sure I would have said 20, 25, 30%. If I had said, gee, did they restructure their spending in a way that put most of the burden on the things I would have hoped for, personnel and infrastructure. I would have said, no, they cut into modern. No, there isn't table one. So I think there's maybe you already knew this in 2008 and I wasn't paying attention to your report, but the data are awfully interesting. I think they defeat many of the conventional wisdoms we have about what's going on in Europe. I don't think that this is a rosy picture necessarily, but it's a different one from the conventional wisdom that we're all carrying around, is maybe my intervention. It's hardly a question. Maybe I can turn it into a question by saying, or am I missing something?
No, thank you. Actually, that's a great way to turn it into a question. I'm going to have to remember that when I'm in the audience next time as well. But I actually think that there are two basic questions that are underlying yours. We were actually quite surprised to see some of the trends that we saw, both initially, and then we're surprised to see them continue over time. In fact, when we sat here with our last update for 2010 data, overall defense spending in Europe from 2009 to 2010 in constant euro terms actually went up. Not a lot, but a little bit, 0.2%, 0.3%, something like that, if I remember right. In procurement, it was about double that, about 0.4%, primarily driven by only five countries, and, you know, Sweden, Switzerland being two of them, so not all NATO and European countries. Nonetheless, it's pretty important to see what the data actually tell you. I also think it's true. We've relied for decades on, if we are doing a major ground force deployment, the Brits will send a division, right? And we could sort of count on that. And I think going forward, the Brits won't have a division to send. Well, but it's not clear to me that over the next decade, we have a lot of deployments that we anticipate where we're going to need a British division. So, you know, the match of supply and demand from a military operations point of view may not be completely out of whack here. And I think the opportunity is there, whether the motivation and the incentives are there, to actually use the declining European expenditure and the opportunity to shape a different kind of capacity and capability, because there's still enormous capability, contributory and alliance setting, that comes out of individual European countries and the collective NATO capability. And what we need to do is recognize how important it is to maintain what we can of what's there, rather than focus on what's being lost that we may not need anyway. So,
just a quick follow-up there. I think, when you use data, publicly available data, by the way, we don't have access here that anybody else doesn't have. I think the data improve, and we talk to the folks at NATO, for example, who produce the NATO numbers, and we'll ask them, hey, what happened, you know, between 2007 and 2008? And they'll say, well, we'll go back and check, and they do. And sometimes there are errors, or sometimes there's changes in accounting standards across countries, and there's lots of different things. So, I think there's an advantage right there in using the data in the way that we are, in terms of it helps improve it. And I think ultimately what we hope is that by sort of collecting this data and putting it out in the way that we are, I think hopefully we can drive some policy change. And I think it's easier to make policy recommendations or any policy argument when hard data are behind it, as opposed to anecdotal evidence.
We're really not very cool. We live for detecting R&D data discrepancies inside NATO and getting them to fix it. And you know, we feel victorious when that sort of thing. Because actually, policy is better when it's connected to data. And data get better when you use them. And that's part of the mission. Graham?
Thank you. Graham Smart, U.S. Crest. I had a question when I was going to speak first, but now I think it's been answered, and therefore I'm maybe just going to reinforce some of the comments. The data is extremely useful, and I think it does suggest a number of sort of fairly dire conclusions. But at the same time, when you go through an aggregation process, as you've clearly done around Europe, and obviously my view of Europe is you typically can't aggregate Europe and get a consensus on very much. And clearly, when you look at the different behaviours and motivations of the European countries towards defence, you also have to bring in the aspect of aspiration. Many of the countries in Europe have no aspirations with regard to what is the purpose of defence. It may have a benefit in terms of defending the home country and maybe even going as far as defending Europe. But there are a few countries where the aspiration goes beyond the home boundary. And I think, you know, in any aggregation process, you tend to lose that. And therefore, building on what was said about regional analysis, and I do believe there's an awful lot going to come out of the French-British treaty work. I think it's important to look at that, because I think there are a few countries, maybe as many as half a dozen, that are taking these problems very seriously. And probably 20 or more that are not taking these problems very seriously. And therefore, when you lump them all together, you get a bit of a mismatch of kind of issues get lost. So just, I think, reinforcing what you've already said in the comments you've made.
That's a good point, I think, about the disaggregated and looking at, and Jesse, you can just pass the mic next to him there for the next one. I think that we do have a tendency to want to look at it in the aggregate, in part because it's the supply side, because from the company's point of view, there is a more aggregated market. From the policy side, in terms of alliances and perhaps implementing smart defense and having a more rational distribution of capabilities across European countries, it's a different picture. And we probably, I mean, the nature of our report is it really doesn't go there. It just sets that sort of thing up. But from a CSIS perspective, that's certainly worth some further analysis and pursuit. Go ahead.
Joel Johnson. Comment and a query on the iceberg and cross-Atlantic integration and the EU directive, the export control reform here. I mean, the U.S. answer to the EU directive in part is the STA, the Strategic Trade Agreement, in which, for example, the state estimates that 11,000 licenses in military electronics will go over to commerce next year. Those will mostly qualify for the STA license-free treatment among 36 countries, including all but two, I think, of the EU. So, I mean, in one sense, we're playing the same game as the EU, and it should facilitate movement license-free across borders. A more interesting one, because you commented on exports, I mean, I've been through, this is the third downturn I've been through, and at each time, of course, both the companies and governments want to solve the problem with exports, of which, of course, there's less market than there is requirements. And there's no question that if the U.S. had had its way in India, Brazil, UAE, we would put out of business, Switzerland, we would be happy to put out of business three of the European fighter companies. And, you know, I don't know whether you think there should be any coordination between Europe and the U.S., of which the companies would fight desperately against, of course, as would our lobbyists. But, I mean, there is a conflict here in that we want to preserve and the Europeans want to preserve, and there's probably not enough export market to preserve five fighter lines, six, et cetera. And so over the next year or two, that's not going to particularly build toward greater Atlantic cooperation when it comes to the export world.
The long-term consolidation of the global defense supply side for the Western world is an understudied project. Ultimately, we've gone in the U.S. from the mid-'80s to today from seven major airframe manufacturers to two from a national security point of view. Two and a half, right? Or 2 point something, right? Rounds to a half. Europe has gone from 13 or 14 to four or three, depending on how you want to count them, right? And there are rising competitors outside Europe and the U.S. that are going to reshape the nature of this. I mean, if you take a 20 or 30 year view, there's perhaps a value in collaboration that nobody is seeing right now, you know, because ultimately China will eat us all when it comes to competitiveness in this regard, or at least that's the view of some. I mean, China has its own problems that it's got to get past first, and it may or may not make it. Very hard to take that kind of a long-term view. I think in the near term, and I certainly don't mean this in the sense of a military-industrial complex, but when you can align the objectives at the national level with the objectives at the company level, there's a lot more benefit to be gained by that from both a benefit from the dollar spent and a national security return on that. And I think the answer to your question really should be viewed through that prism. I'm not quite sure what that answer is, by the way. I don't think it's in the U.S. interest for Europe to go to zero. I don't think it's in Europe's interest for Europe to go to one. But you can't sustain. I mean, the market's just not going to sustain the level that's there now. So can you possibly use greater integration to move in that regard? How much of that is demand and how much of that is supply-driven? I don't have a good answer for that. And I think we're going to go through a pretty rocky patch over the next few years because you're right. We can't all win the limited market that's out there, and the market that's out there won't save us.
And if all of that isn't enough, most of the countries that the Europeans and the Americans are competing for business from are asking for more tech transfer and building up their and assistance in building up their domestic defense industrial bases. So yep. You might sell there in the short term, but not for very long.
Yeah, Brazilian aircraft are competing for U.S. defense contracts now, right? And so this is not a world that I grew up in and not one that I expected. This is a daunting audience in front of which to speak because there is, in fact, a level of collective experience on European marketing and delivery and European analysis and policy that dwarfs what we have up here on the table.